They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally, they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
But bye, 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 bye. But bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
Okay, Dude Badders, so this is a really interesting one. So a little while back, I went on a bit of a reading binge. And one of the books that I read was a book by Scott Carney called What Doesn't Kill Us. And I found it absolutely fascinating, absolutely brilliant book. And what it explored in there was this whole idea that we are far too comfortable. And the thing that really intrigued me about the book was that it was an exploration. It went into thinking about Wim Hof and the Wim Hof method, which I'm sure everybody who listens to this podcast has heard about. But actually arriving at the point of understanding that the Wim Hof method, being very skeptical, someone that was very skeptical about the Wim Hof method, then going and doing it and then sticking with it from then on, especially a journalist and someone, an investigative journalist as well. So, you know, as journalists ourselves, we're like hugely skeptical about everything. And so I really, really wanted to get on Scott, the author of the book, to talk about not just his experience with the Wim Hof method and everything that went around that, but just the broader themes really around the whole physiology that, you know, we are very, very differently adapted as how we were previously, but also just to hear about the experience of, you know, speaking to all the different people and actually going through the process of finding the weird and wonderful individuals he found in the book and then talking about something. So welcome to the podcast, Scott Carney.
All right. Thanks so much. I love sounding so much more interesting in your intros than I actually am. That's fantastic. Appreciate that.
Well, we can be the judge of that. But yeah, the very first thing that sort of really caught my eye about, so you do that typical thing where you read the back of a book or you read the synopsis for a book and it says in it, someone who is incredibly skeptical has written this book and they've completely changed their way of thinking as a result of the sort of the investigation that they've done. And you think, oh, that is an incredible marketing ploy use. But then when you actually read into it, you realize it's true. And then you see, you know, all of the previous investigative work that you've done, you know, obviously backs that up. So I suppose that the kind of like the first questions really where the starting point was, like, where did you kind of come from in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, what made you think that like investigating these kind of interesting stories about, because I think, you know, the previous book, The Enlightenment Trap, but the one before that was about someone dying in a Buddhist retreat. Where did that come about, like investigating those kind of things? What was it that kind of piqued your interest about those kind of stories?
Well, exactly. So the back in 2006, 2007, I had been leading this abroad program. I was like a dropout graduate student, you know, totally sort of disenchanted with the whole academic life. And, you know, to get some extra cash, I was leading these like 20 American students throughout North India. My research area was India. So I speak Hindi. I've been there for a long time. And we were going to all these like sort of holy sites from North India. On the we go to Varanasi, we go to Delhi, Agra, and we end up in Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha attained enlightenment about 2,800 years ago. And we do this like 7-day silent meditation retreat in the, you know, Tibetan tradition. You know, there's a nun teaching us this whole time. It's totally silent, can't talk to anybody. And like my best student, a woman named Emily, is just sitting there just like enraptured by the lectures and then just totally like in like full lotus pose meditating on this stuff. And I'm like, wow, she's having a great time. And then on the last day of the retreat at this retreat center, you know, we were all starting to talk again and everyone's like, oh my God, I can speak. And, you know, I had this great experience, blah, blah, blah. And And then I go to bed, you know, happy that we had this great experience. And then she climbs up to the roof of the retreat center and jumps off after, you know, wrapping a cloth around her face, jumps off, hits the ground, and dies on impact. It was probably about 3 feet from where I was sleeping. So here I am, this teacher of these students, suddenly responsible for her, you know, sort of the dead body of a student. I'm like 27 at this time. And the first question is, why did she do it? And so I open up her journal, I start reading through it. And, you know, long story short, the last words are, I am a bodhisattva. And all she has to do is leave her body, and then she'll be like reincarnated as enlightened being. Right. So the question in my mind, one of the questions is, how does meditating on enlightenment and nirvana and all of these and bliss and these beautiful concepts that are part of the of Buddhist tradition, how does that end up in the madness of suicide? And then also I'm dealing with her like trying to preserve her corpse in like 110 degree heat, which in English in Celsius is 40 something. I start to write books that all sort of stem from this one very traumatic, horrible event. The first book I write is about organ trafficking, because one of the things that happened in that week was that a lot of different people were trying to get pieces of her body, and I had never experienced this in my life. No.
Oh wow! Like in what? Like just approaching you and
no.
Like how does that work?
It's like the police wanted like parts of her brain and her liver, you know, and like insurance companies had stakes and like not wanting to transfer it because you know there's a great deal of money on the line. The parents wanted the body. I was suddenly involved with like having to photograph the body. It was just a lot of intense stuff. When you see a human body go from a living animate, right, to this immaterial corpse, this sort of led on to this like, multi-phase project where I moved to Chennai after this, which is a South Indian city, and I start to, I learned that a village right next door to where I lived, everyone sold their kidneys, and so I sort of go off and start looking at this, and. With Emily, the realization was that you are you when you're alive, but when you're dead, you are meat. Okay, so this is one of the realizations that happened on this, early in my life. But the question that was dogging me was like, what is the connection between her realization, right? How does that positive realization end up in this very negative outcome? And so I spent the next 4 or 5 years. In addition to looking at organ trafficking, tracking down people who took their own lives on retreats or went insane on retreats. And I identified this, what they call India syndrome, which is this idea that people go to these foreign countries or India, but it really happens in other countries too, with all these fantasies about what they're going to encounter in these foreign lands. And some of them get really caught up in these meditation techniques, these mythologies of like magic powers that come from yoga or, other things like that. And those ideas of that faith sort of take over their brain. I'm not describing that perfectly, but, essentially like you have this idea of magic, then you're meditating and when you're meditating, you feel things differently, right? You've never meditated before, you meditate, time speeds up, it slows down, light looks different, blah, blah, blah. It's like a little psychedelic. But when you couple that with the idea that there is enlightened beings floating around the Himalayas, like you can suddenly think that you're an enlightened being floating around the Himalayas. And, there's a fairly extensive group of people who go crazy doing this. And then this gets added on to by other sort of like unscrupulous gurus who want to capitalize on that. And in America, and I'm sure also England as well, there are all sorts of people who are like, meditate your way to wealth. You have your like sort of problem. You probably have some yoga sex cults going on. You probably have like all of these things where you marry this sort of mystical idea of sort of Asian religions and like sort of like overblown ideas of like the miracles in those traditions, marry that with the Western idea of like exceptionalism, and boom, you've got this idea that you can meditate your way to either superpowers or wealth or as much sex as you want. I mean, really, whatever you want. You can sort of get that out of the tradition. So I wrote a book about another group of meditators in Arizona, where this one particular white Tibetan Buddhist monk named Geshen Michael Roach basically taught this really corrupt form of Tibetan Buddhism. And it ended up with another guy meditating to the death in the mountains while his wife, who was a goddess in the area, goddess with quotes, I'm doing air quotes if you're listening on a podcast, goddess, had stabbed him at one point. And then as he was dying of dysentery, just sort of sat there and tried to meditate him to health. And then obviously he passed. So this is my background, okay? This is where I am when in 2010, I see this picture of this like shirtless dude on an iceberg in somewhere in the Arctic Circle, right? And he's, you know, basically naked in this cold area, you know, meditating. And I see this picture and I'm like, this guy is offering these miracles, and he's going to sell it to you because he just has his first training course ever coming up. His name is Wim Hof.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is like, one, it's very appealing, right? Appealing, you know, I can be impervious to the elements. It's like super macho and super appealing. And I'm like, and so I know there's like commercial potential behind it. And I wanted to get out ahead of it to write the book that this guy is like another sham cult leader. So I get Playboy magazine to sponsor my trip out there. They had just published my article on these meditators in Arizona. So they were like hot for another like debunk the guru thing. And I fly out to Poland, you know, middle of the winter. At this point, I was living in Los Angeles, you know, warm. Before that, I was living in India, warm. And I'm in Poland. This is the winter that stopped the freaking Nazi army. Like, it's cold. And I get off the airplane in Wrocław, and I meet Wim Hof, and I am immediately totally unimpressed with this dude. Like, he is like, he smells bad. His nose is bright red from years and years of alcoholism. He's short and he speaks like just nonsense out of his mouth. And I'm like, oh great, I'm going to go learn a meditation technique from a homeless dude.
That's actually, you've drawn a line there between, you know, your experience and then, you know, seeing what it looks like from sort of inside different, almost cult-like situations. And then you end up, just kind of backing up a little bit, just to, you know, launch this in the right way. Was your motivation for doing that? Because you wanted, you saw there was a certain element of vulnerability for the people doing that. That, you know, that actually they were kind of selling selling something they could never appeal on. And how does that? Are there people doing retreats the right way, like Buddhist retreats the right way, and are they the wrong way, or is the whole thing flawed in the kind of enlightenment that it offers a Western audience?
Sure. Well, so. Yeah, these are big questions. I tried to just gloss over them as we launch into our Wim Hof stuff. But so, is there a way to be spiritual and sane? Yes, there are. And there is a beautiful tradition in Buddhism that is great, right? That I mean, there's bad stuff in all religions, right? It's a human, they're human institutions, whether or not there's a God, they're definitely human institutions, and they are as flawed as the human beings who run them. But there's a lot of great stuff to learn. I think meditation is an amazing, you know, there's lots of different meditation techniques, but broadly, like, it's a different way to look at the world, and that is beneficial to who we are, right, as people. And if you go into these traditions, there, I would say most people get something good out of them, but a lot of people get confused by them. You know, the Dalai Lama has this great quote that he says over and over again in various ways, that if you were raised in the West, you should study Christianity. He says, you don't be a Buddhist. Like, don't come over here and study Buddhism because you're going to bring with you all of your understandings of religion. Because you reject Christianity because, like, you know, those priests, those horrible things, like I hated catechism or whatever, right? And then you're like, but in the East, it's perfect. And like, Dalai Lama's like, no, like, do your own tradition. You understand the problems. Don't assume some other tradition is perfect. And that's really what this thing is. I mean, there are amazing priests in the Catholic tradition, right? There's amazing Episcopalians, and there's even great C of E people. Like, there's all sorts of great spiritual people, but it's really in the practice more than just the institution. And there's definitely charlatans in all of it, right? Yeah. People who misuse these good spiritual insights for their own ends. Sometimes they are confused and they think they're doing good. Sometimes they're just doing bad because they want to make themselves better. I mean, it's all of the variety in the world exists. However, I will say something particularly problematic with the idea of enlightenment as we talk about it in America and in the West in general, is that we have conflated this idea of enlightenment with an idea of Christian heaven, where we have this idea that you arrive at a location, enlightenment, and then you are there, you're infallible, you're perfect, you've arrived. The idea of enlightenment in Hindi, which is, or not in Hindi, in India, which in Sanskrit is Bodhi, is wisdom, right? And it's more like you are enlightening. It's more like a verb than it is you've gotten it. Because anyone who says they're enlightened is freaking crazy. Just like anyone who says they speak to God is freaking crazy. That's not how this works. And once you get to that point where you think that you're perfect or you have achieved perfection in any religious tradition, you suddenly have no peers, right, anymore. And there's no one who can tell you, well, actually, I don't think God said you should sleep with all of your beautiful. He's like, nope, I talk to God, you don't get to sleep with them. And this happens, like, again, in all traditions. So that's one thing. The other thing is this idea of superpowers, like people trying to get something that's more human than human, like something that's like if you think about like what an Indian who'd never heard of Christianity, like gets their first like YouTube video about Christianity downloaded into their head, and they suddenly realize that Christianity is all about duplicating fishes and walking on water. You can sort of realize how an American learning about yogic tradition is like, well, it's all about stretching yourself and like telepathy or something like that. Like it's just like sort of very broad miscommunication. And so when I heard about Wim Hof, he is saying he can meditate on the ice, control his body temperature. He also says he can control his immune system at will, which at that point was considered scientifically impossible, right? Mind over matter. He's saying these things that are sort of, if not miracles, very close to it. Yeah. And it just so happened that the ice thing in particular is in the Yoga Sutras. And it's called a siddhi is like a miracle in the Sanskrit tradition. That's the word is siddhi is like you meditate a lot and you get this power. It's considered a minor siddhi, like the idea of like being able to sit in this ice. And there's Tibetan Buddhists who practice something surprisingly similar in the Himalayas. And at that point, I thought it was sort of bullshit. I thought those monks had some trick and didn't work. And just like this other stuff didn't work. And I was going to go meet Wim Hof, debunk his fraudulent claims. Because, I mean, how many other people are there? How many you can pray your cancer away? Like, that's sort of what he was saying. And I thought that was bullshit. And I don't think I'm out on a limb having these ideas. And so I went out.
The thing is, at the moment, I mean, the way that – because it got to a point with Wim Hof, isn't it, where – and I think this actually is a wider point about almost like the productization or marketing of,
yes,
of these kind of things. And you will find, like now, certainly, you will find those kind of claims on the internet, about the Wim Hof method. You know, it helped me cure my fibromyalgia and all of these things. And so, but at that stage, I mean, it's been a few years since that. Like at that stage, where was Wim Hof like status in terms of being known by people? Was it just a few sort of members who were kind of talking about this and making these claims, or was it just him sort of pushing on in his own?
Well, you're actually pointing out something that I was probably going to get to a little later, but since you brought it up now, we'll get to it now, is that, sort of my book, my 10-year journey doing the Wim Hof method, Wim was a nobody when I met him, right? This was his very first training session. There had only been one scientific paper about him. He had this dilapidated farmhouse that they bought with the money from an advertisement from Columbia Sportswear, and that was basically the only place he'd ever been known. The advertisement's very funny. All these people are jumping into ice water, and someone offers him this electric coat to heat him up. He's like, I don't need that. I'm Wim Hof. And like that was that, but that's all Wim Hof was known for at this point.
It was like gimmicky, wasn't it? It was like a git. It was like, totally. We've got this, we'll hire this crazy guy to do something gimmicky. It'll look great.
He was a clown. Essentially Wim Hof was a clown. And one of the results of my work, because I was the first real journalist to cover him. I mean, people had covered him as a clown before, but I was the first person to be like, no, there's something here. This is awesome. And there's these things in the technique that are really great. And I ended up, because I ended up learning to do all the things that he could do very quickly. And it was a big shock. And I sort of like helped launch his credible career. After that, Joe Rogan picked him up. After that, Vice picked him up. They also are mentioning my initial Playboy article. And I'm basically saying, look, Wim Hof, this method, there is something to it. And there's physiological reasons. But at that point, Wim Hof had a lot of like interesting potential. Who knew where he was going to go? And I will say that what you're saying now, where this group has these crazy statements that are coming out saying he can cure bacterial infections, that he can cure fibromyalgia, he can cure cancer, AIDS, COVID. Now, Wim Hof, if I was going to write that article right now, I probably would have come up with a different conclusion. Because I think that what Wim was then was this sort of like guy who had this amazing thing to teach the world. And he earnestly wanted it. And I still actually think Wim Hof is still very earnest. I don't think that has changed. But I do think that the marketing stuff around him that has grown up in the last 10 years has gotten very money focused, has gotten very cynical. And Wim now hangs out with all these like celebrities all the time. You know, he's hanging out with what's his name? Yeah, Russell Brand, right?
Oh,
he's hanging out with Russell Brand all the time.
Everyone does eventually. Yeah. That's it.
Right. And Russell Brand, you know, he's a funny, interesting guy who is not a rigorous scientific dude. He believes in aliens. He believes, you know, he's – and so Wim is now taught – is like parroting back bad science. He is – the group really wants sort of your $300 to do his like online free training session and to book him to speak somewhere is like 50 grand. I mean, it's really, really financially motivated in a way that I would be very suspicious of it now. So I'm in this like weird place because on one part, I know the method works, like, because I do it all the time. I climbed up Mount Kilimanjaro with Wim Hof in my underwear, all the way to the top of the mountain. And I did it really fast and everyone was really surprised. And like I built my career writing the book, What Doesn't Kill Us, and the follow-up books about this. And yet I am so, so hesitant about the bullshit that's coming up around the group at the same time.
And so, I mean, did that occur to you, the kind of shift that would create? So you've gone through a career of basically, you know, debunking these things. And then you discover something that works and you're like, there's something in this. So from a personal perspective, great. From a story perspective, incredible.
Right.
But then, you know, everything that you're saying now is that, you know, you've become part of that beast. You're part of that story. Yep. How does that kind of sit with you? And does that, do you struggle with that from a, you know, then investigating other things as well and thinking, you know, because I'm sure people will look at you and say the same thing like, well, it was in your interests to do it. Yeah, there's always people that say that. Oh, it's in your interest to do it. You found something early on and you've latched onto that and it works for you. And that's kind of similar to some things that other, you know, you could have been saying about other things earlier. People haven't read that in that much detail.
Well, the thing is, if you read What Doesn't Kill Us, you can see in the writing in that book, I'm sort of already struggling with this. And, you know, I mention in one of the chapters when I'm in Holland, I mention how the business is sort of taking over, especially with his son, Anam Hof, I mentioned how the business is becoming, a barrier to interacting with Wim Hof. And then at the end of the book, I mean, the big message in the book is I don't follow Wim Hof up Kilimanjaro. I see that he is an incredibly flawed person who almost got us all killed on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. And I did this because I have this power in myself and so does everyone else. That's the end. I call him a madman and a prophet in What Doesn't Kill Us, because he is. Like, he's got something about him which is very charismatic, which makes you want to go do something. But it's not freaking superpowers. It's just like he did some cool stuff. He's a cool person in a lot of ways. But I think it's the thing that I'm actually very happy that I put in the book is like I'm knocking him off the pedestal in What Doesn't Kill Us. I'm like, look, forget Wim Hof. Like him for opening the door, but don't worship him as like something special. He's just a really interesting dude. And I think that there's a lot of interest in creating a sort of almost godlike figure out of him, yeah, especially in the marketing from that organization. And also the people who try his method feel really cool and then are like, oh my God, my guru, because it comes out of fucking nowhere, right? It just comes out of their brain. They're like, hey, this guy made me feel good. He is special. And I think we have, you know, a lot of collective madness in America, in the world right now. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the world is freaking insane. So it's not shocking that people are like, well, let's do another freaking insane thing and worship this dude.
Let's find lots of mini religions. Let's find, you know, this religion to follow. Let's just find something that will help us make sense that we can follow in a rigorous religious way. The thing you were saying there, which I thought was really interesting about the book, and I've watched a lot of Wim Hof, you know, videos, the Vice videos and everything. And there was a particular video, and I just wanted to, you know, marry what I saw in this, which I thought was slightly mm-hmm. different from other videos I've seen. But there was a video of him taking people, they were obviously, in Poland at the retreat there. And everyone there was going there expecting to learn the Wim Hof method. We wanted to learn the Wim Hof method. Did we learn? And they were all panicking because he hadn't taught them the breathing. But he was making them do lots of different things. And it was very off kind of brand based on what we know now. But he was kind of saying that you don't need, he essentially said, you don't need the method. It's you. Right. Fighting against the elements. It's you. Right. You can do all of those mm-hmm. things, which it marries like almost the exact message that you had at the end of the book. And, is a message that has sort of resonated through any kind of, religious overthrow thing mm-hmm. that, everything is within you. And I just wondered whether, that is how you found him to be most of the mm-hmm. time until this, everything else, this structure.
Until the most recent iterations. Yeah, I mean, I think to a large degree, he is still that guy when you're hanging out with him in person. It's really the infrastructure around him that creates a different thing. But it's hard to like disconnect the two as well, because he also feels like he's super cool for hanging out with Oprah and Jason Statham and all these other people. So his ego is growing. But I think in general, in the interpersonal thing, he's like, yeah, it's just in you. And there's also, here's a shocker, there is no Wim Hof method. Okay, I'm going to blow your mind. There is no such thing as a Wim Hof method. There is instead only a set of Wim Hof principles, which is put yourself in a difficult situation in like the cold and relax in the cold. Boom, you've got the Wim Hof cold side. The other side is breathe a hell of a lot, exhale and hold your breath. That's the other side of his method. When you do those two, that's his with the quotes around the method. But it's really about the internal state that you create when you're fighting against that external force. And this is what I sort of, this is that not only he didn't invent that idea. This idea goes back to the Stoics. It goes back to the ancient yogis. It goes back. I mean, it's in every tradition. Wim Hof didn't even invent cold water. You may have not believed this, but cold water was around well before Wim, and people had been swimming in cold water for a long time before Wim.
That's the other thing. And I want to relate this actually back to the points you were making earlier when we were talking about, enlightenment and, the fact that, and again, part of what, so when I read your book, I also read it in conjunction with Civilized to Death. Mm-hmm. Talking about how, as a Western society, we have created, you know, productized things which are entirely natural, or we've, you know, turned into we've made things which should be extremely natural very unnatural now. And, you know, part of that is, you know, our physiology and the environment, which, you know, you kind of dealt with. But also, you know, exactly what you're talking about, like this whole thing, like, the, you know, now swimming in cold water is cold water therapy. Taking a walk in the woods is forest bathing. You know, really, it's like really basic. Obviously, you know, going for a swim in a lake is wild swimming. You're like, these are just perfectly normal, natural human thing. Trail running. You're like, well, that's assuming that you've.
It used
roads.
To be called running.
It was, but you know, for 90% of the world that don't have roads around them, all running's trail running. And so it's almost as though, you know, it's almost like a going back to when you. When did it kind of, you know, occur to you, like on this journey, that there was something bigger there in terms of the message that you were going to get out, that, you know, that you were going to have in the personal effects of, you know, this working with you? But did you have this sense of, I can tell the story of this and I can reach a lot more people?
You mean when I was writing What Doesn't Kill Us, or just
yes, absolutely.
Oh, I knew while I was there, before I'd even climbed up Snezka, I knew that Wim Hof was a captivating individual who I could write a really compelling book about. I mean, it was obvious that was there, just because in my own self, I went from being someone who was very skeptical to being like, oh my God, this works, because I'm standing out, I'm in cold water and I feel comfortable. And there's that internal surprise that I was like, oh, there's something here. So I think.
But wait, there's a gap. When you first turned up, you were really unimpressed.
Right.
You were completely unimpressed with how he looked. So what happened between then and that moment?
So we got off. So we drove into Snezka. We drove to his place, and the first thing that happens is I go up to the bunk room where me and the two other people on this training session, because there were only two who were interested at Wim Hof at that time. we throw our bags down. I look out the back window, and one of, like, somebody who had thus come to, like, individually study with Wim Hof before that, was standing outside in his underwear throwing snow on himself in the Nazi killing winter, and like steam is coming off his body, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? I've never seen that. That's crazy, and I don't want to do it. That's the first thing, because I was like, oh, weird, right? Second thing that happened was that evening I was hanging out with Wim, and we're playing chess, and we're probably drinking whiskey, right? We're playing chess and drinking whiskey, and we're just talking about what I should do in the week that I'm here. Because as an anthropologist, remember I was an academic, my degree was anthropology. I almost got the PhD dropped out, blah, blah, blah. There's two ways to go about reporting, right? You can observe from the outside, or you can participate from the inside, right? And both are useful in various ways, because if you're not part of it, you can get the sort of objective view, but where if you jump on in, you're more subjective. And I decide that during this chess game, I can sense Wim's earnestness, right? That whatever crazy homeless stuff is going on in his brain, I can tell that he really believes it, and that's just a sense I got. And when I sensed that, I was like, what's the worst that can happen, right? Worst thing that I get is frostbite, but I can probably get out before then. And frostbite's not that bad, right? I mean, I've been doing, like, you know, war correspondent shit in India for a long time. Like, I've been in dangerous situations, so the idea of being too cold, it's not like he says, like, you can survive inside the core of a fire. Like, that sounds more dangerous to me. So I was like, okay, I'm going to give you a shot. I'm going to see what happens, and we'll just go from there.
So you heard earnestness in his voice, and you had that conversation. I take you that was a demonstrably different experience from the other people that you'd met in your career beforehand when it came to investigating all of the other situations whereby, you know, they were exploiting that and putting people in harm. Would you make a comparison with them? Or
I would say, so with the guru that I just sort of debunked, I actually also sensed that he was earnest, and I also tried his methods. I also tried some of his meditations, and and I got a feel for what was going on there. I mean, meditation didn't transform my life, right? But I was like, okay, I get what this is about. Because even if you're a charlatan, sometimes there's a kernel of, actually, usually there's a kernel of truth in the charlatans, right? Because the best lies that are out there are 90% true. And it's just that 10% where we switch it over to insanity. And so I'd been meditating off and on for years before this, and I will often go in to do things, but I never really know until I'm there, because the things that go on in my mind before I choose to say yes to something is, do I think it's going to be dangerous for me to do that? Yeah. You know, when I was doing war correspondent stuff, I was fine with bullets. I was not fine with landmines. So there's like, okay,
it's good that you can make that distinction.
Yeah, right. and so I figured Wim was more like a bullet than a landmine. So, you know,
I've just got to explore that a little bit. So you're happy to take bullet, or the possibility of being hit by bullets, rather than the threat of walking, having to even contemplate the walking through landmines.
Yeah. So the exact situation where that came up, because it's going to be contextual. Like, I'm not going to be like, well, I'll stand in front of a firing squad because that's a bad idea, right? But the situation in that case was, I was going to go on a patrol in central India with sort of the army who was fighting a communist insurgency, and it was like he was like, okay, well, you know, you can come on our patrol. You know, we know where we're going to attack the Maoists. Tomorrow, it's a 12-mile or 20-mile hike into the jungle. I was like, cool, I love hiking. You know, we can't be responsible for your safety. I'm like, I get that. You know, there will be bullets. You know, there will be some shooting. And I was like, okay, well, I can probably hide behind a tree. Like, I don't need to be in front. We're on the ambushing side instead of the being ambushed side. You definitely want to be on the attacker, not on the defender in these sorts of situations. And then, And then he's like, oh, and there could be land. because landmines are random, right, to me.
Yeah,
and then with the bullets are like, you know, you aim. You're like, I'm going to go for this person. Like, I feel like I have like some negotiating power with the bullet. I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy. That's just my own freaking brain. Welcome.
See, this is useful. This is very, very useful context to see when you're getting into, you know, work with Wim Hof. And so you had that conversation over chess, and you thought, okay, the thing about a lot of what he does, it must look at, you know, the reason you chose to investigate in the first place is that there are probably people that get in situations where you can easily see them suffering and dying and everything else like that. When did it become clear then that this was different? This wasn't what you'd seen before.
Well, I'd never seen anything like it before, so that was very easy. Like, I didn't think any of this was possible. So there was definitely surprise and shock in me the entire time, because, you know, as an denizen of the modern world and growing up in constant comfort, seeing people do hard things looks impossible, right? And if you're more warm, the colder stuff looks even harder. And if you're a more cold person, the warmer stuff looks harder, and, you know, in various other iterations too. And then when you're in the environment, you start to realize that there's a negotiation between you and the hard thing that you're up against, whatever that hard thing is. And it's in your nervous system. It's like, can I do this? Can I not? It's in the feeling of, you know, can I relax in this environment? Can I actually get over my initial anxiety and fear and actually just deal with the thing that's right here? And that's a very powerful lesson. Like, throw you in ice water and then tell you to relax. That is like this very amazing meditation that anyone can do. It doesn't, and was done well before Wim Hof, right? Is it because the environment's screaming at you, clench up, bite me. And then if you tell yourself, I don't need to fight you, I'm going to be fine anyway. And then you do will yourself to relax. And then you realize, oh, actually, I was fine anyway. I definitely can do this. That is like magic in the soul. And it has nothing to do with like the like Wim Hof allowing you to do this, giving you some sort of like prana injection up your butt. That did not happen. You just found you could do it. What Wim Hof is great for is showing and sort of demonstrating to anyone that they can all open that door for themselves. So big ups for Wim Hof, especially in the last you know, 10 years, he's really shown people that this is possible, just like people in the 1930s and 1940s and the 20s, 1890s, 1840s are all have been these repeated cold bathing movements that have happened through history. Wim is by only the most recent iteration of.
And how do you think
we keep forgetting?
How do you think that message goes down particularly well? I mean, it's not the kind of message that's going to get you a sponsorship, or from because there's so many people invested. The idea that actually as a human we don't need the fleeces, we don't need all the high tech equipment, we don't need all of those things. It's kind of like the Born to Run message, isn't it? Yeah,
right.
So you don't actually, you don't actually. And that kind of had a little bit of a backlash against it. I mean,
have you read Born to Run recently?
Yeah, not recently. So, I've read it a while ago, and I was one of the ones that went out barefoot.
Nice.
Got plantar fasciitis within minutes. That kind of
great. So Born to Run, I feel like is an amazing book that you absolutely do not have to read. It's one of those books where you open it. I have it on my shelf behind me. Yeah, where you open it up and you read like two or three chapters and you get it. You get it. And you know what you want to do? You want to go out and fucking run. And I don't think I've ever finished it. And I've opened it up many, many times. And I've read parts of it. But it's like the book is not about being a book. The book is about getting out there and going running. So it's selling an experience. And the writing is, I mean, it's fine. The writing's fine in that book, but it's like, it gets you out to go and do it. And that's actually, hell, I wish my book was that good, honestly. I wish my book was like Born to Ice. And
but that's the thing. It does do that, doesn't it? Because you're fundamentally challenging something. Because, we can... Everything was about improving our physicality, then improving our diet, then improving our mental strength. And actually, the one thing that was missing from all of that that wasn't talked about is our environmental factors and,
right.
And how the environment, we aren't connected to our environment anymore. And we don't, our bodies are not attuned to the temperatures around us, and not attuned to how often do we walk barefoot on grass and feel how it is? How often do we put a phone away and actually navigate according to the things around us? All skills which we had only a few hundred years ago, and we've kind of lost that. The other thing that I kind of wanted to explore in this conversation was. When you went through the process of this, when did you have the idea of bringing in other ideas about that challenged
right.
things about what we know about our physiology and what we know about what humans are capable of? When did the Spartan story come in? Where did the weights under the water? I mean, how did you even find the weights under the water? Place. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that must be a subculture and a subculture and a subculture to kind of pull those in.
So what I wanted to, after I climbed up to the top of one of these many mountains I climbed up to in my underwear, right? And it was like, it was 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's like, I don't know, like 15 Celsius, maybe. Is that 15 Celsius cold? No. No, it's below that. Sorry, it's negative 15 Celsius. Is that cold?
That is cold.
Yeah. Okay, so it's like negative 15 C out. And I'm warm on the top of it. And I'm looking down at my skin. And I'm like, it's like I'm in a wetsuit. Like, I can feel the cold, but I don't feel cold. And I'm like, this is amazing. And the question is this magic prana being shoved up my butt by doing the Wim Hof breathing? Or is it... is there some sort of evolutionary thing behind it? Now, I'm very science-minded. I did not think that Wim was a magic wildebeest. I thought he was just a dude with a cool idea. And then, so I spent the next, several years researching the evolutionary understandings of how the Wim Hof method works. And it is, it's just, we are a very robust species. We're about between 200,000 and 300,000 years. I could plop you into Paleolithic land and they'd be like, yeah, that's one of our dudes. And they would just recognize you as one of their dudes. And it would be, you'd just fit right in, although you'd probably suck at everything that they could do. And
I'm morbidly obese by their standards, I imagine.
And morbidly obese. They're like, wow, look at all the fat on that dude. Let's eat him. That's probably what they would think, actually. But they recognize you as the same species. And, you know, the humanity, which, you know, emerged in Africa originally, right? Homo sapiens is in Africa. Neanderthals came out and they went to some, and Denisovans went out to some other places. But we started in Africa and then we really spread right across the globe, one with some technology, but not technology that you would consider interesting. It's like, you know, we skinned rabbits and put them on our bodies and that was technology. That was great. We have this actually very, very adaptable physiology. Like we're jacks of all trades and we have very big brains that sort of allow us to think our way to use the environment to our benefit, but also that just our bodies are robust and they are for some reason very, very elastic. The thing, one of the primary drives in every human brain is this idea of the striving for comfort, right? And I think that comfort is hugely useful when comfort is not the norm. When you're like, oh shit, I'm in a bad place, I want to get to a good place, that's a great like psychological drive to be in every person through the pleasure principle. And like I got to get over that mountain because there's going to be bananas on the other side of that mountain. And the banana is the reward. That banana tastes great. And it's this sort of idea of like hardship and the contrast to comfort, which is awesome. But now when I just go to my kitchen and there's like 12 bananas, 6 peaches and 4 raspberries, I don't have the same reward. It's just sort of like, yeah, money did this. And so we are in this like fundamentally disconnected state where, you know, instead of like having to build a fire because you're warm, you flip a button. And so our bodies actually don't have the contrast of any sort that we once had because we can sort of like fine tune, we can like optimize comfort. And it's just offered to us on a plate since birth. More or less. And I can only imagine what a kid right now gets offered, right? You know, even in my day, if I had got lost in the city, I had to use something called a map or like ask people for directions. Now you don't even have that. So actually we're getting less and less adapted as we get, as we progress into the future.
What did you do as a result of going through, of that experience? Mm-hmm. Were you focused it primarily on your on the sort of the mental state that it would create with you? Was it more of a health thing? Because the thing is, lots of things are drawn into it now. Like you know, talking about making our bodies more in tune with the environment and actually going back to a state where, you know, we have brown fat on us that allows us to be out in the cold and, you know, do all this thing. But it's all been associated, all been bundled in with, you know, and there's massive health benefits and it, you know, helps our blood pressure and it helps anxiety, it stops anxiety and things like that. And you're like, well, you know, on that, you know, if we use, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, if we have to survive, then of course we're not going to suffer from anxiety. If we, you know, if we're cold and we have to do things, mm-hmm. like what, I think the difficulty is, how do you integrate that into your life? How do you integrate, how does a modern person integrate that into their life and get the benefit from it without kicking their kids out in the cold and saying, deal with right. that and all sorts of problems. That, I think that's it's like the connection between that. And I suppose like Wim Hof offers an insight into that, but how do you integrate that into your life?
So one thing, ever since meeting Wim now, is in 2010, what's it, 2021 right now. So 11 years ago when I first met Wim, I recognized the benefits of the breath work and the cold immediately. And I just kept up with it. Like I was just like, cool. It's an easy practice. It only takes like 15 minutes in the day. Like I was like, it's sort of like modular in that sense. And the other nice thing is that I used to get canker sores all the time, like big like mouth ulcers. Yeah. And as a complete random side effect of doing the Wim Hof method, those sort of went away and never came back. So I always had this like stick. I was like, I knew I could do this breath work, and then that sort of autoimmune mouth ulcer would go away. And cool, I just made that connection in my brain and it proves true over and over again. You like, they'll start, they'll like, oh, they'll get that little one. I'm like, I don't like that. And then I do the breath work and it dies. So I'm into it. I just get sort of like shoved back in. And like, how do you integrate this stuff? Well, You find challenges that you don't want to do, and then you do them. Like, that's how you do this. You know, you're like, what is it that scares me about, like, being in a situation that's scary? And then you just go do it, and you try to relax and do it. And this is what I wrote another book called The Wedge, which is essentially the book is, after you've been doing the Wim Hof method for 10 years, what next? Right? And so I'm looking at all sorts of things to give myself an external stimulus, whatever that is, that demands my body comes up with a response. Like, so ice water, it's obvious. You A, look at ice water and you hate it. You're like, fuck no. You get into the ice water and your body wants to constrict. And then you override that and you relax into it. And this is what I call the wedge. It's that sort of gaming what the environment wants to do, and then you deciding how you respond. So again, I didn't invent, I sort of am the first person to use that particular word, but I didn't invent this concept, right? It's in all of the yogic traditions. It's in a lot of meditative traditions. It's been around for a long time, where you know, I'll do saunas and I'll mix it with cold. I'll do this thing where I throw kettlebells with a partner, and throwing kettlebells looks really, you know, sounds really douchey, but it's really at this, you know, it's like playing catch with this 30 or 40 pound weight. And the idea behind that is the motion is very easy to catch a kettlebell, because, you know, you look at a video and someone teaches you to do it. It's super easy to do, but there's an inherent risk with throwing the kettlebell, breaking someone's foot, yours or theirs. So you have to do it very carefully. It's an environmental situation that you create, that instead of like just looking cool on Instagram, it's trying to build trust and empathy with the other person. So you try to create these situations where you're able to, where you have a decision in your brain where you have to adapt to the new circumstance. And so that's really what I think I got out of the Wim Hof method, is that I go on and take on challenges. I intentionally put myself in places that I feel uncomfortable. And then I say, can I handle this? But I still also hang out on my couch and do Netflix. You know, I still also have a nice office that I work in. Like, I don't go crazy. I don't want to be a caveman. I don't think anyone alive right now wants to be a caveman. But there are still lessons you can learn by realizing that your environment's talking to you all the time, and it's like seducing you all the time. And you have to sort of like step back sometimes and be like, wait, do I really want to be seduced right now?
Because the lot of people that listen to this podcast in particular, run ultras. Like, we've all run ultras. We've, done that kind of stuff, and never really can explain why people run, 100 miles, because there's no practical use for it. And I'm sure that, if you didn't have to run 100 miles, which you don't, you try to explain why you're doing it, you don't. And that's always been the thing of, like, it's about pushing your boundaries, but that's normally from a mental perspective. We're not running 100 miles in a loincloth and nothing else. And I've never And I never really understood. Well, David comes from an OCR background, so he did OCR, and I've always joked about OCR, but saying that, it's basically for people with, attention deficit disorder. You know, you need to be doing something every few minutes. But it wasn't until I read your book where I started to understand some of the OCR stuff, like understand the Spartan Gate, understand why putting yourself through that kind of suffering made sense, because there is, I think as you just said there, something's calling to you. Something is calling to you, like this, I don't know what it is. My body has to feel as though it's being challenged. And I wonder whether, there's just something inherent within us that it gets to that point, and maybe it doesn't switch on for everyone, but it's like something calls to you.
Yeah, I mean, in What Doesn't Kill Us, so that I do two OCRs in it. One of them's The Tough Guy in England, right? Where it's just, considered, it's very famous in England. It was considered like the coldest race in England. I did it in a Speedo. No, I didn't do a Speedo. I was in shorts. I wished I had a Speedo. I wanted an American flag Speedo, but I couldn't find one.
How can you find that? Surely that most Speedos are. Because
by the time I realized that I wanted it, it was already too late. Like, it was like, I was on the, like, getting to the starting line. I was like, shit, I should have been in an American flag Speedo. But you know, there are people who run this race in wetsuits, like literally neoprene. And I'm lined up in just like my skivvies, and I'm saying to myself, And on the start line, I'm thinking, I'm very cold, right? I'm just sitting there. I'm with everyone else, like, am I an idiot for doing this? And then, you know, the can, because they of course they have to launch the cannon. A starter pistol won't do it. The cannon goes off, and we all start running. And like almost instantly, I get this feeling that, you know, I just love doing crazy shit, right? Like doing crazy shit makes me feel good. And then that cold that's on my skin, I did this mental trick. I said that cold on my skin is the sensation of the love that I have for doing crazy shit. So it's sort of like this voodoo you do in your brain. And then I just felt awesome for the entire race. And I'm just point of fact, I am like the worst runner ever. Like everyone's passing me. It's less like thousands and thousands of people are passing me because I'm shitty at running. But I'm also out on the course longer than anyone else because I'm in the first heat because they put me in the beginning. And then, you know, it takes me 3 or 4 hours to finish this obstacle course race. But I'm loving every minute and it's just like freezing out there. And there's just sort of this, the nice thing about the cold is that there's this constant give and take. Right? Because the cold is just present on you. And you're like, oh, I'm getting cold. And then you get to think to yourself, but I could warm up. And then there's this thing that happens where you do warm up. And then it's just fun the whole time. I mean, of course, there's limits to this, right? There's a limit where it can get too cold and you will die. There's no doubt. But when it's not there, when it's like sort of well within the limits of just your mind saying like, yeah, this is really uncomfortable, then you have a lot of, you realize how much you can expand as a human.
And when, you know, some of the other things that you, so that was one of the things that you explored in the book, mm-hmm. when you were looking at other ways that, you know, your environment can affect you, and the way that people go to it. And of course, we talked about the weights under the water. Were there any that you looked at that what did you reject? What did you go and have a look at and go, I can't put this in the book. This is insane. Or looked into it and thought that no, there's no way.
So there's two things that were cut out of the book. So the books are What Doesn't Kill Us and The Wedge. They're sort of like a continuation of one another. One that I kicked out was cold water surfing, where you're, you know, there's these people who surf all winter in America and probably the UK as well. Yeah. And, you know, I grew up on near Cape Cod, which is, you know, there's some surf breaks there. And I'd never done cold water surfing. And so I went out to meet this one guy and I was like, oh, cool, cold water surfing. We're going to have all of these like benefits for me in the cold. But the dude was just wearing a wetsuit and he was in cold water. And I tried on the wetsuit. I was like, oh, you're just warm. It's just, you've got cooler technology. So I ditched that. Like there's this whole thing. I was like, what's the point there? And so that came out. Another thing that came out in the wedge, which is a follow-up, was nutraceuticals was one. Like there's all these people who sell cognitive enhancing drugs, which make you smarter and faster and whatever, more adjusted. And so I hung out with this group in San Diego who actually had, you know, when you talk to them, they really sell how these are going to change the world and how like these mental states, there is like these things that you can, you know, that you optimize and, you know, they use Silicon Valley words. But anyway, I tried their shit and I was like, oh, it's like I'm high on caffeine. And I was like, bullshit. Like it did nothing for me. Like I was like the nutraceuticals and the other thing is that there's no active component to nutraceuticals, right? It's not like you take it and then there's something to resist. It's not like a psychedelic, right? A psychedelic I will write about because that is a new environment. It's creating a new environment and you have to guide your way on this journey through your brain. I'm into psychedelics for that sense, but I'm not into like this bro science, vitamin mania that's out there. So I kicked that out. And another thing that I kicked out was electric stimulation. So there's these all these devices that you can put on your head and like use magnets and electricity and currents to change the way your brain works, supposedly for better. And again, that was the same problem, is that there was nothing to push against. You wore this hat, and then it supposedly made you awesome, And then you took the hat off. And I felt like that was probably also just snake oil. And when I did like investigations, because I do my due diligence on these people, the inventor like made some pretty crazy claims about like making billions of dollars in the stock market, yet he wants to give this device to the world to like, you know, make horses better and humans better and like all this shit. I was like, you just sound insane to me, and you're not going to come back with us. And he also wouldn't meet me for an interview because
oh really?
Because he's crazy pants and he knows he would get just well, I mean, I would have just not included him in the book because I, you know, my job right now is not to debunk people. It's more just to tell them. I want to tell people what I thought worked, and I didn't. I wasn't writing the "these people are all shitty." Those books are out there. Like, there's a lot of "these people are all shitty" books, and so I didn't really need to do that.
The I think like from the in the book, one of the most interesting parts of that I think is towards the end where you know I'd obviously watched some videos with Wim Hof. And I'd seen how he was with people, and you know, and like you say, it was like a genuine interest in them pushing against mm-hmm. you know their environment and you know really changing. And then reading the end of the book where he kind of goes off in a stomp, you know, up Kilimanjaro. You know, he was with all of you, and then all of a sudden he you know wanted to go off and get it done because you know he felt like other yeah you probably
so yeah
that, but it, so, it, but we, it's just it's the it, it's kind of it kind of went against what I thought he was about in a sense but you chose to follow him him and do that. I just like to explore that a little bit more because that was I think that was a really interesting insight into him and obviously a key insight for you in the book itself.
Yeah, so in the beginning of this thing, so we're climbing up Mount Kilimanjaro, we're doing it very fast.
And what faster. Is fast? You can remind me, because normally it's
we're going to do it. Yeah, it's usually 5 to 6 days to the top. And it's not because it's hard, it's because you want to acclimatize as you go up, right? Because, you know, there's less available oxygen. If you go up too fast, your body doesn't adjust to the available oxygen and you can get altitude sickness. So it's not like the physical feat of going up in terms of your muscle work. It's like more the physical feat in terms of like you don't want your blood to boil thing. And so we were going to do it in 30 hours, which was like crazy fast. And we asked the Dutch Mountaineering Association what would happen. They're like, you're all going to die. And we're like, okay, cool. And there's like 30 of us. So we sort of sprint up. And what we're doing is the Wim Hof breathing the entire hike up. So the idea is like as the oxygen gets more less and less dense, if you breathe more, you keep your oxygen levels high. So if we're going to breathe for 30 hours all the way up to the top. Like, and we do. We go up. One person gets altitude sickness, but everyone else is like fine as we go up. And then we get to this one stopping point where we're at the like the final ascent. We're like, you know, just one last push, and then we get up. But there's like a hut there, and they're going to make us lunch. And we've been walking for like 24 hours at this point, so like lunch sounds awesome. And Wim is like, no. We got to get the record. We got to get the record. There's no time for lunch. And you know, skipping lunch normally sounds like, yeah, fine, whatever, skip lunch. But skipping lunch when you're at like the very edge of your physical abilities is a whole nother conversation, right? And basically there's a mutiny. Everyone says no. The guides are like, it's way too dangerous just to go up right now. They don't go. And Wim just sort of like runs up the mountain. And I'm sitting there. And I've been like naked this whole time. I'm not naked, but like in shorts this whole time. And I'm like, God damn it, Wim Hof. Why the fuck are you going up there? But I'm like, but I got this damn book to write. So and if I didn't have the book, I wouldn't have followed him. And so like in protest, I like put all these like layers on. I'm like, fuck it. You know, I put on like a Uffy that I had in my bag. And I sort of like give up on like the cold stuff. And I'm walking up behind him. And incidentally, no one else had done it shirtless. Everyone else was like, no, we're going to do it with clothes on. I was just the idiot doing it unclothed. Because it was the
dedication,
point was
the dedication to that.
Right. Even Wim had like a blanket over his shoulder. So I was like definitely the odd man out. And so I run up after him and like you know, like, I guess like two people sort of followed him a little bit, and then they ran, they decided not to. And then I was like, Wim, slow down, I'm coming. And he's like, don't you fucking challenge me, Scott Carney. And I'm like, dude, just slow down, I'm trying to catch up to you so we can go up together. And you know, eventually he's like, okay, just plot up. And so it was just me, one other dude, and Wim Hof, who, out of this group of 30, who actually went up. And, you know, I'm seeing Wim as this sort of like, you know, at the beginning of the trip, he's like, you know, at the base of the mountain, he's like, in this journey to the top of the mountain, there is no ego. There is only we go. We will all be a group together, and we'll be like, yeah, next to each other this entire time. And then we're like, oh, cool. Okay, we got it. We're all in this together. We're like a team. And then like immediately he just sprints out ahead of us. We're like, what the fuck? like within like 2 minutes, like he's like, peace. And so we see, like, he's got some physical ability, which is pretty cool. Like, he's a very robust guy. He knows he can do it. But he gets so solipsistically focused that he's the only thing that matters. And he does things that are dangerous. And I'm realizing that he's putting me in danger, the rest of the group in danger. And I, you know, as I'm going up the mountain, I see him slip a little bit because he's also freaking tired, right? He's also not levitating up the mountain. He's like, oh, you know, he's also flagging. I see him slip, and I'm like, wait, like, this is like my moment where I reassess that I'm not following Wim Hof up the mountain. I'm following myself, and this is about my relationship with the mountain. And Wim, though he may be a prophet, we cannot forget that he's also a madman, and you should never want to be Wim Hof. And so I just sort of like relax a little bit. I'm like, okay, I'm just doing this on my own. And then I take off a shirt and I sort of like, you know, undo some of my protest and walk up the mountain behind him. And I think that's the most important lesson that you can get out of this book, is that it's not about Wim Hof. It's about you. It's about your relationship with the environment and how those two things interact. And Wim is just the guy who opened the door for me.
It feels as though Wim Hof is permanently on the verge of a mutiny happening around him. Yep. Because I suppose that's the situation when you are constantly pushing people and you are constantly doing it. And I wonder, you know, I've only seen it, you know, from a kind of a distance, but I wonder if there's like that becomes that shift where you have people following you and you have people doing that, and they maintain that element of critical thinking like you have, and go, okay, this isn't about the man, this is about me, this is about I'm going to use my common sense to do the things that I've been taught to do, right, and mm-hmm. I will follow my own path. And then it kind of shifts into everything that this person says is brilliant. And you see that all the time, you know, when someone does something like that, all of a sudden, and I think, you know, the whole thing with COVID and stuff like that, is that whatever they pronounce, you know, they've got a very specific thing that they've taught people, right, and people follow it, and all of a sudden they switch into talking about something completely different or another field. Totally. It's like, we follow him as the leader and everything he says. And that, I mean, that must be a characteristic of when things go bad.
Yeah, it's like the idea of like influencers in the world right now. Like, what the hell is a fucking influencer? Like, your job is not to be influential in like a certain area of expertise that you might have, but like, I influence in everything. And Wim Hof is like the worst of that in some cases, because he's really only qualified to talk about like, inspire you to go to the cold. But now he's talking about like, don't take the COVID vaccine because you can breathe COVID away. Incidentally, you can't. In fact, if you have COVID and you breathe heavily in a room, in a closed room with a lot of other people, you're going to give them COVID. And this is actually like, it's like my personal battle right now with this whole world, is that people really do sort of follow his crazy pronunciations as if they are the law. And he's like wrong. Like when we were first learning the method, he was like, yes, when you breathe fast, you increase your oxygen levels to above 100%. And that's how we thought the method worked. Well, one, you can't go above 100% in anything. Like, no one can give 110%. You can only give 100%. Two,
you can if you're a motivational speaker. You can always give 110%.
But two, the power of his method has nothing to do with oxygen. It has to do with CO2. Half this has to do with when you're hyperventilating, you blow off your CO2. So the CO2 is like, you know, you're normally let's say you're normally at 100% CO2, and then you drop your CO2 levels down to like 30%. When you do that, because your body doesn't detect available oxygen, it can only detect the rising levels of CO2. That's the reason you can hold your breath so long when you do the Wim Hof method, is because you've blown off all the CO2. You're holding your breath and you're just building up that CO2. He didn't understand this mechanism at all. I had to go like talk with scientists. Now he can explain it better, but talk to him about mitochondria. And he's like way off the you know, like, yeah, you're lengthening telomeres like with your brain. And it's like, no, you're not. That's not what's going on. telomeres are cool. Your brain is cool. It is not all connected in the way that you think they are connected. And in some ways I'm okay with it, because one thing that you want is to realize that what we should be focusing on is sensations. Like, you're in here and you feel like you want to gasp, but do not gasp. And then you'll like build resilience. I'm fine with that explanation, because that's what your experience is. I do not find it compelling to be like, you breathe in some way and here's the mechanism that works, and you explain a detailed mechanism. And especially when you're wrong about it, it's just like voodoo science. It's just some bullshit.
It's all connected. I mean, it goes back to the ancients explaining how the sun rises or something. Like, you've got the mechanism and we can see the mechanism works. And now we're just trying to overlay it with something that makes it just like tries to justify it and makes you feel better because you have an explanation.
Right. And the explanations are often wrong. Like, I mean, you know, you just look at like diet, right? Like in the 40s, we were like, well, the reason my heart disease so bad is because you eat so much. If you eat fat, that's going to make you get heart disease, and it's going to make it worse. And then if you look at the current science, you're like, no, fat was fine. Eat as much fat as you want. It's sugar that's the problem. And like, you know, we have these paradigm shifts all the time, and we have these ideas of what's going to make you healthy. And yet, describing the mechanism just because I use a Latin term does not mean it's accurate. And I think that you'll see bro science all over the fucking internet right now, where someone drops the word mitochondria and people are like, oh my God, mitochondria is cool. I was talking with Dave Asprey the other day. Yeah. So Dave Asprey is a bulletproof diet dude. Yeah. And you know, we're just chatting before some interview, and he's like, you know what's going to be big next? I'm like, what? Peptide. And I'm like, what the fuck? like, how can something be big in human physiology?
It's so true, because you know, my background is writing health promotions, and you know, in health and fitness, especially in like strength and conditioning, things like that, it went through the same thing. It was always, you know, it was about different hormones. We'd go through different hormones, and one hormone would be, there'd be a trend because people would be searching for this particular hormone, and then we'd talk about it, and then it would be something else, and it kind of has that the mechanism becomes the hook. It kind of like dieting as well, I suppose. There's always got to be some kind of hook that people kind of hold on to in order to sort of think. Do you think that the fact that people are holding, because there's a spiritual element to it, isn't there? People are holding on. They want to find some element of spirituality in this. And I wonder if there is a pattern, between.
Well, you mean in the Wim Hof stuff?
Because there is a spirituality. People want to, the same people who go to sort of, Buddhist retreats are looking for something, and the same way that the people that go to these are looking for something that they can't find anywhere else, or they don't think they can find anywhere else. And it sells itself as the panacea to it, all the better. Mm-hmm. Whereas it often isn't.
We're looking for that one thing, right? We want the one thing that will make everything else in whatever it is that we're doing. Like, how often do you hear the word optimize right now? Like, have you optimized your diet? Have you optimized your running? Have you optimized your Wim Hof breathing? Have you optimized your
my
sex
son,
life?
My son said he was upgrading his muscles the other day, which I thought.
Yeah. but it's this idea that there is a perfect state in some way, because optimal means perfect, at least for you. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't get better than optimal, right? There's no super optimal, right? There's just optimal and I guess suboptimal, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that the way we conceive of health is very subjective, actually. Like I could say right now I feel great. I feel like I feel healthy. I feel strong. You know, overall, I think I'm good. But if I wanted to talk to a bro scientist, they could come to me and be like, "Well, your mitochondria aren't talking well enough. I can do a test. I can smell your breath and tell that you know, whatever, like you ate the wrong thing. And then, hey, look, I'm looking in your earwax, and like, boom, like, you know, do you blink the optimal times per minute? Better think about your blinking." Like, there's this like sort of like over measuring sort of like bullshitness out there that you can sell in a way, especially if you have like a VHS program, not VHS anymore, if you have a video course, right? That if you have a video course that can teach you how to blink the right number of times a minute, and the optimal blinking will keep your eyes perfectly moisturized and then better, or whatever it is that they're the output that they're doing. And I think that that's a real problem in the world, is that people are giving away their own subjective experience for someone else to tell them, usually, and they're offering like a one size fits all approach, right? They're like, well, you need this many blinks per minute, you know, to be perfect. When in reality, it doesn't matter, A, or B, if it did matter, it's probably different for every person. And I think that we sort of like give ourselves diseases by thinking about what optimal is without necessarily paying attention, without like looking inside and being like, how do I feel? How am I in this? And what do I need my health for in what particular moment? Like, I don't need to free solo El Cap, right? That's not like that my optimal health does not involve free soloing El Cap. So I don't need that part of health in my body, even though you might look at Alex Hanold and be like, he's famous, right? but you see what I'm saying here? Like, it's this over-examination.
And is there, I mean, there's another element as well of kind of, and I think this relates back to the Enlightenment element that you were talking about as well, is that it is in the West, we like to get to a point where we're done. We like the idea of this is done, rather than this is a constant process that we're always going through. And I suppose that's the, you know, you've been doing, you know, elements of what you were inspired to do through the Wim Hof, you know, what you've learned with him over a 10-year period, which is, you know, the idea that to tell someone, you know, this is a 10-year journey, or this is something that you work on all the time, or, you know, you can't go and dip in the lake three times and then hope that all of a sudden you're going to, you know, you're going to suddenly be devoid of these. That's a difficult thing. Is that something that's explored in the Wedge as well, in terms of, you know, that a constant need to constantly challenge yourself, rather than this kind of tick box exercise of, oh, I'm going to do this checklist of things that are going to challenge me in my life, and when I've done them, boom, I'm going to be sufficiently challenged and everything is going to be great.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's implicit in the Wedge, because I think that sometimes checking boxes is okay, right? I think sometimes being like, I am never going to go back up Kilimanjaro in my underwear. That box is checked. I don't ever need to make that a habit.
Is it what, too comfortable? Too comfortable.
Right. Right. But I do think that we never arrive, because there's no goal in life, right? There's no, you've made it. Like, at the end of the day, you're going to be forgotten in like 1,000 years. Nothing you did in your life is going to matter. I promise. Probably one person here who's like, no, I'm going to murder 100,000 people. It's okay, I'll be remembered. But like, in general, like, we do not get remembered in the future, and that's okay. Like life is about living in the moment, doing the best you can, being a good person. I think that is in sufficient in and of itself. I think it's being a good person is important. And but at the end of the day, you're going to die, and it's probably going to suck. Right. These are my two like fundamental principles in Scott Carney's philosophy of the world. You're gonna die, and dying is gonna suck. Okay. And given those two things, how should you live your life? And actually, it's very freeing to realize this. It's like, well, I'm not living to be like comfortable on my deathbed. right? That's not the goal. Like that may happen. And sort of like that would be like an optimal way to go. Maybe comfortable on my deathbed, people crying around me like you were so great. Like that'd be great. But that is not why I do things right now. But once you realize that the stakes are death, and this actually goes into the Wim Hof stuff and all of these other programs I do, is like death is like sort of coded into your neurology. Like when you're holding your breath in the Wim Hof method, you're fighting against the urge to gasp, and that urge to gasp is death, right? You want to breathe air because if you stop breathing, you die. So like these things are like fundamentally wired. But I think that if you start realizing that's a very big picture, that it's going to end, it's going to end badly, tells you that you should live your life to the fullest right now. And it also weirdly implies, at least to me, that you're obligated to take risks in your life, right? You're obligated to go out there and do things that might be uncomfortable, that might be weird, that might challenge you to grow in ways that might even be unexpected. Because at the end of the day, the stakes are always the same for everyone. Whether I stay at home and I have 2.5 kids, live in an air-conditioned box and, grow big around my middle or whatever, that I have the exact same output as the person who has adventures all the time. Like you both equally die. That's like the great leveler. And so of those options, why not go out there and take risks that even could shorten your life, right? Don't aim to shorten your life, right? That don't go embrace death, but be like, look, if I'm doing things and I'm challenging myself and it might kill me, it might make me feel awkward, it might do these whatever the failure state is in that question, at least you did it and you make decisions based on whether it's worth it.
I think that is a perfect place to end on with that kind of message. Just talking about death. Just to kind of
Good
wrap up on
ending.
there. What? Yeah,
Classic
exactly.
ending. Classic ending.
It's predictable. It's predictable. What are you working on next?
Oh shit, I got so much going on. Let's see. Next, I just released The Wedge like a year ago. The next book is totally different. It's not even on anything like this. It's about the 1970 Bhola cyclone that killed 500,000 people in Bangladesh and then started a war, flipped an election, started a genocide, and almost brought the United States and the USSR into nuclear conflict. So this book has nothing to do with the stuff that I've been doing so far. But this book is all like an allegory for climate change. Like even though I'm just sticking in 1970s and just talking about like Nixon and like the genocide that he funded and the war that kicked, sorry, the storm that kicked this all off. What we're really talking about in this book is that as we face a global climate catastrophe, there's going to be more and more storms. We know that. They're going to be more and more powerful. We know that. And storms don't only hit coastlines, they hit political systems as well. And so, my fear when it comes to climate change is, yeah, there's going to be some adaptation that happens environmentally because we have fires and food problems and all that stuff that we already are thinking about. That's totally there. But that's not what's going to get us. What's going to get us is the massive waves of refugees and then the responses to that and the wars that come. Like, that's what we're worried about with climate change.
And that's interesting, actually, because even with the pandemic, we kind of started seeing that. It was sort of the whole idea of it's not going to be, I suppose, and we're seeing things like video games, like The Last of Us, and every zombie movie. It's never the zombies that get you. It's how the other humans react to the other humans. It's how we deal with those situations. And so that's what that you've written that. That's being published, or you're in
It
the
comes out
process.
in March 29th in the United States and probably around the same time in the rest of the world as well. And yeah, it's called The Vortex. It's an awesome book. I co-wrote it with my friend Jason Micklin, who's a we went to grad school together in my anthropology days, and then he went on to be a professor, and he's like a super famous professor right now. And so, we used to have this thing that we would like write one crazy story every year. We go on an adventure together. Remember I told you about the landmines? Yeah, he was with me as a
Oh,
landmine
was he?
conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. And so now, and we went to Bangladesh in 2000 and I forget, like I think it was 9 or something, when India had built a wall around Bangladesh. There's a wall, and they've armed it with some psychotic soldiers, and they're killing people. And they built the wall because they're worried that all these climate refugees are going to come in and flood India. And This is not something we talk about. We talk about the wall on the southern border of America all the time, but that place is a freaking flashpoint because you have a postage stamp that just lost half of its area, and all the people living on that postage stamp have to go somewhere. And you look at a map sometime and tell me what surrounds Bangladesh.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Amazing. And if people want to follow you and keep up to date with you, what's the best handles to follow?
My website, scottcarney.com, C-A-R-N-E-Y. And I'm S.G. Carney on Instagram and Twitter. And I just deleted Facebook. So I think I'm there, but I'm not. I'll never log in.
You never escape Facebook, even if you're not there.
I created a fake account. I have a fake account with a fake name that now controls all of my official profiles, but I haven't logged in 2 years. So I don't know. Good luck.
Amazing. Well, brilliant. Well, this has been absolutely amazing. I really do appreciate you you coming on and talking about some of the stories and sharing your experiences as well. So thank you very much, Scott.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I must admit I was a clone to be messing around, but that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Come back, yes, and give me one more try, cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.
Hey, this
We're is just running long.
You haven't listened to the podcast before, have you?
No, I haven't listened to it, but hopefully it's good. It better be fucking good.
It better be good.